It sought a technical six-month extension of UN Resolution 2231 to encourage continued cooperation between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency. Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi condemned the measure as a sordid mess caused by the US and E3 states' persistent misrepresentation of Iran's peaceful nuclear program.
Iran's position on snapback is clear. It is illegal, void, and has no standing. The E3, having breached the deal, cannot claim significant performance. Resolution 2231 restrictions will expire permanently on 18 October 2025. Any attempt to revive or extend them is null and void.
Araghchi asserted that the E3's intent is confrontation rather than constructive dialogue. Referring to the June attacks by Israel and the US on Iran's peaceful nuclear facilities, Araghchi said that military actions failed and that the snapback mechanism will also fail to resolve the decades-long dispute over Iran's nuclear program. The top Iranian diplomat emphasized that Tehran will never bow to Western pressure. He reiterated that the only solution to the dispute is dialogue and diplomacy. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has praised the sacrifices of the martyred resistance leaders in foiling U.S.-Israeli schemes against Muslim nations. The IRGC statement was issued on the first anniversary of the Israeli assassination of senior Hezbollah leaders and commanders. It honored senior leaders Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and Sayyid Hashem Safieddine for their exemplary prudence and courage in transforming the resistance into a global symbol of dignity and strength. The IRGC cited active and intelligent resistance as the only effective means to counter global arrogance and Zionism. It highlighted the escalating Israeli attacks on Gaza, noting that they revealed the regime's inability to eliminate resistance. The IRGC reaffirmed its commitment to supporting the resistance until occupation is eradicated and Al-Quds is liberated, describing this mission as divine and unstoppable. Iran's top security official says Martyr Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's remarks decades ago that Israel will not spare any country have now been clearly proven true.
And those statements by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah made several decades ago, and some countries maybe didn't believe, it has become clear now to everyone. Today become clear to everyone that it doesn't show mercy on anyone. The incident in Qatar proved it clearly.
Larijani is in Lebanon to attend Nasrallah's memorial ceremony. He said recent developments have further revealed the true nature of the Israeli regime to regional nations. Larijani also praised the long-standing relationship between Iran and Lebanon, underlining the solidarity between the two nations. During his visit, Larijani is also expected to hold meetings with top Lebanese officials. More Palestinians are killed in the Gaza Strip as Israel pushes ahead with its genocidal campaign in the besieged territory.
We were just sitting there when the missile suddenly struck, without any warning at all. I was still standing on the stairs. I live in the house just behind theirs. I was about to step inside when, by God's mercy, I was spared.
They said they were heading south, and then we heard they had been bombed. The news came that my sister and her family were all martyred. What had they done? We keep running, hiding from one place to another. What did they do to deserve this? We are displaced.
At least 40 Palestinians have been killed across Gaza since dawn, including desperate people looking for aid. The focus of the attacks remains on the northern Gaza city, with more than 70 bodies transferred to barely functioning hospitals in 24 hours. Carpet bombing of the city's northern, eastern and western areas has forced overcrowding in the south. The regime's tanks are also rolling into the city's populated areas, preventing rescue teams from helping those trapped. Meanwhile, in central Gaza, a 17-year-old boy died of starvation, bringing the number of deaths due to famine and malnutrition across the strip to 440. Since October 2023, over 65,500 Palestinians have been killed, with more than 167,500 others injured. The United Nations has announced the addition of 68 companies to its blacklist of entities benefiting from the Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. According to a report, the companies are complicit in violating Palestinian human rights through their business ties to Israeli settlements, which are deemed illegal under international law. The new list includes a wide range of firms, from suppliers of construction material and earth-moving equipment to providers of security, travel and financial services. The list now contains 158 companies, the vast majority Israeli. The others are from the US, Canada, China, Britain, France and Germany. The UN has called on companies to take meaningful action to address the adverse human rights impacts of their operations. The Israeli regime has escalated its settlement expansion in recent years, defying international condemnation and mounting demands to cease those activities. Facing a chorus of global condemnation, Israel is confronting unprecedented isolation as diplomatic, cultural and economic pressures mount. This was shown by a mass walkout preceding Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's address to the United Nations General Assembly. The incident symbolizes a broader international backlash against the war in Gaza, which is now manifesting in official state recognitions of Palestine and widespread boycotts of Tel Aviv.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has addressed the 80th session of the UN General Assembly. Before he began his speech, many countries walked out of the session in protest over the genocide in Gaza. Speaking to an empty room is another sign of Israel's growing isolation at the international community. This isolation is the price to pay for the regime's murder of innocent Palestinians and rejecting the global call for an end to the bloodshed. Netanyahu has acknowledged Israel's isolation, but he describes it as an unavoidable consequence of the Gaza war. Speaking this month at a conference, he called on Israelis to become more self-sufficient. He said Tel Aviv has no choice for the coming years, and it is required to deal with the isolation attempts. Global outrage over the dire humanitarian conditions in Gaza, including famine, has swelled in Europe and elsewhere as demonstrators demand that their political leaders do more to stop the crisis. In Italy this week, thousands of workers and students participated in a nationwide strike over Gaza that closed ports and some public transit hubs. The domestic pressure has played a key role in pushing European leaders to find a way to act. Several Western countries, including Britain, France and Canada, recognize the state of Palestine this week. Momentum is also building in the cultural space as well. Spain, Ireland and Netherlands have all threatened to boycott Eurovision 2026, the world's largest music competition, if Israel participates. Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez called for Israel to be excluded from all international sports, similar to how Russia was banned from the Olympics following the outbreak of the Ukraine war. In the US, more than 4,000 film workers, including A-list stars, signed a pledge this month to boycott certain Israeli film institutions. Despite fierce objections from countries across the globe, the regime is pushing ahead with its genocidal war on Gaza and attacks on regional countries. The regime struck several areas of Yemen on Thursday. Just this month, Israel attacked six countries, including Qatar. For now, it seems that while US backing may shield Israel from immediate diplomatic consequences, it cannot reverse the deepening global alienation. This international isolation appears set to intensify as long as the current policies persist.
A Palestinian-British NHS doctor has been cleared of charges of misconduct, defeating a complaint that her anti-Israeli views made her unfit to practice medicine. The case, brought up by the group UK Lawyers for Israel, marked the second attempt to have Dr. Rami Aladwan's license revoked by the General Medical Council. Latifa Abu Chakra reports from Manchester.
The UK's Medical Practitioners Tribunal Service has ruled that Dr. Rahma Al-Adwan is fit to practice, rejecting accusations of anti-Semitism stemming from her social media posts and public appearances. The case, which was brought by a pro-Israel advocacy group, marks the second time the doctor has successfully defended her license against such complaints. The tribunal's decision reinforces the legal distinction between criticism of Israel and anti-Semitism, in the context of professional conduct.
There's no purpose having a free speech if it doesn't entitle you to offend other people. And, you know, and that's, you know, we live in a democracy, and that's meant to be the cornerstone of our society. So Rafa's done nothing here today apart from exercising that right to free speech, and we all must do so.
The pro-Israel groups alleged that Dr. Al-Adwan's precise terminology, specifically her use of Jewish supremacy instead of Zionism, was in itself proof of misconduct. They argued that this linguistic choice amounted to harassment of British Jews and made her a risk to Jewish patients. The tribunal's dismissal of the charges represents a significant legal blow to the strategy of equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism to silence criticism of Israel.
It's clear that this is not an isolated case. Campaigners point to a wider pattern of the pro-Israel lobby in the UK going after professionals who speak up for Palestine, from teachers to lawyers and now to doctors.
Dr. Al-Adwan's supporters have thrown their full weight behind her case. Amongst them were three doctors facing similar allegations in pending tribunals.
As doctors, we respect the sanctity of life, and this genocide goes exactly against that. And in addition, it's not only the genocide in Gaza, naturally, that we strongly oppose and want to stop. We also oppose the Zionist lobby working overtime to suppress doctors' free speech.
The high volume of complaints filed with the GMC against doctors for expressing pro-Palestinian or anti-Zionist views has in itself been labelled a form of harassment.
I felt like there was a sense of shame from GMC Council. They were not there because I've harmed anyone, and they were not there because I'm a danger. They were there so that they do not upset the Israel lobby.
In its decision, the tribunal cited Dr. Al-Adwan's right to freedom of expression under the European Convention on Human Rights, which in a democracy rightly held more authority than the Zionist lobby. Latifa Abu Shahra, Manchester.
Pro-Palestine activists have once again rallied in Paris to denounce the US Israeli genocide in Gaza. Demonstrators also condemned French complicity in Israeli crimes and urged their government to cut all trade and diplomatic ties with the regime.
France, the French government, is still complicit of the genocide in Israel. So if they don't want to take sanctions, we are going to take the sanctions. First of all, amplify and grow the boycott, a boycott of Israeli products and all the firms that are complicit with genocide. But also, we must think now of blocking the economy. This is very important. This is what we are saying today.
The genocide that is still continuing for 2 years in front of the eyes of everybody, thousands and tens of thousands, uncountable. We absolutely have no count in the amount of Palestinian civilians who have been killed, who have been starved to death. People are still under starvation. Thousands and hundreds of thousands of people are being thrown out of their tents since their houses have been completely demolished. People are being deprived from their food in the front of all the eyes in an attempt to expel them, to genocide, to kill them, to steal their land, to expand colonialism in Palestine, to expand colonialism in Gaza and the West Bank. We want the French government to understand what the French people are telling it, end supporting of Israel, end collaboration in our genocide, end that, not just a fake recognition of a fake Palestine.
Venezuela's foreign minister slammed the U.S. military activities in the Caribbean Sea, saying Washington is spreading perverse lies to justify aggression.
Today, the aggression is directed at Venezuela, a peaceful and supportive country. Since Venezuela cannot be accused of possessing weapons of mass destruction or nuclear weapons, today they invent vulgar and perverse lies that no one believes, neither in the United States nor in the world, to justify a monstrous, extravagant, and immoral military threat worth millions.
Speaking at the 80th session of UN General Assembly, Hill said the recent U.S. strike on a vessel in the South Caribbean was in violation of the UN Charter Venezuela's sovereignty and even U.S. law. He said the U.S. seeks to topple the legitimate government of Venezuela and exploit the country's vast oil resources. 11 people were killed in the recent U.S. military strike in the southern Caribbean. The U.S. claims they were smuggling narcotics out of Venezuela, but Caracas says none of them were drug traffickers. U.S. military officials are also reportedly considering options for targeting alleged drug traffickers inside Venezuela, with potential strikes anticipated in the coming weeks. And with that, we bring this news bulletin to an end. It's goodbye from me, Bahman Ray.
شيء واخر يا إيه. and all the enemies of the prophets were either themselves were oppressors or supporters of the oppressors.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Foresight, and I'm your host Mehdi. Please stay with us. كل شيء ومليك يا رب كل شيء وصانع يا خالق كل شيء. Today's tip: following an oppressive leader will surely destroy our ubudiyah. Welcome back, dear friends. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about how following an oppressive leader will destroy our ubudiyah, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. So this concept that we're talking about, it practically states that if an individual follows a leader who is oppressive, then they destroy their religion or they destroy their ubudiyah. So, of course, just to kind of shed a little bit of light on the subject, we find that the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, he says that one who subjects himself to following a oppressive leader unendorsed by the Almighty Allah has no religion. So, of course, when we're talking about religion, we have said throughout our programs that ubudiyah, the worship and the servitude and the obedience to the Almighty Allah, is religion. Religion is the ubudiyah, the worship and the servitude and the obedience to the Almighty Allah. And so, this religion that we have, this ubudiyah that we engage in all of its various different forms, this ubudiyah can be ruined and destroyed, and it can go to waste if we subject ourselves to following a leader that is oppressive. Now, we can give some very concrete examples that will very clearly explain this, concept that we're trying to put forth, and that is that if we subject ourselves to following a leader that is oppressive, we will destroy our religion, we will ruin our religion, we will destroy our ubudiyah, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah, which is what we're trying to do, is to increase our ubudiyah. But in this manner, we find that we might destroy our ubudiyah. And so, when we go into the past and we see that there were certain Muslim leaders that they didn't really follow Islam. And so because they didn't follow Islam, they claimed to be Muslims, of course, but because they didn't follow Islam the way that it was and it should have been followed, they committed a lot of oppression. Now, if an individual were to subject himself to following, the orders and obey this oppressive leader, then according to, other traditions, this individual who follows a leader that is oppressive is, in reality, part and parcel of the oppression of that individual. So, perhaps one of the most hated figures in all of the history of Islam is Yazid, the son of Muawiyah, of course, who killed Imam Hussein alayhi salam in the Battle of Karbala. What would we consider ourselves to be if we had followed him?
IRIB.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Holy Quran says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم قد كانت لكم أسوة حسنة في إبراهيم والذين معه. He says, you will find, and there has been an example for you, a good example for you to follow in Ibrahim and الذين معه. We can take examples for those who have this question in their mind of non-ma'sumeen. According to this verse, الَّذِينَ مَعَهَ. When the movement of Imam Khomeini began, out of all the qualities that our late Imam Khomeini had, the one that is most outstanding, the one that we have felt the impact of in all the other dimensions or because of this, is his political stances, is the impact that he had in the political world. He shook the entire globe. When the movement led by Imam Khomeini reached its success, what happened was there was a campaign by the Western countries, or led by the Western countries, against the movement of Imam Khomeini. Amongst what they have done, or what they did at that time, was to present the movement of Imam Khomeini in a way where the people of the world would not like the movement of Imam Khomeini. One of the areas that this occurred in regards to the movement of Imam Khomeini, was to present the model of the Islamic government to be a totalitarian government as opposed to a democratic system. Wilayatul Faqih, according to Imam Khomeini, especially with the emphasis on the mutlaqa part, that this is unconditional power that the faqih and the jurist has in the political system of Wilayatul Faqih, the way this was portrayed to the masses is that this is a dictatorship. One man has control over everything in this country. That's what the concept of Wilayatul Faqih is. In the Islamic political thought, the leader has a responsibility, the people have a responsibility. The leader is not going to force the people to do what is right. He's going to tell them, this is right, they get a choice, they don't want it. This is the Islamic system. The Islamic concept is people have the choice, whether they like it or not. All people are making choices. People in this country are making choices, people in the US are making choices, people throughout the globe are making choices, but they're either right or wrong choices. The difference between an Islamic leader, a Muslim leader, a divine leader, and a non-Muslim, non-divine, even if they call themselves Muslim, is that the leader that is divine never lies to the people. He tells them what's actually good for them. They may see the truth in that, they may not, but he is never going to lie to the people. A Muslim leader doesn't manipulate thought, doesn't fabricate the truth, but tells them what the truth is and guides them in the right direction. People follow, we're going to be successful. People don't, and they listen to the lies of the media, then that's when the others are going to be successful. It's been like that throughout history.
Mother, don't cry for me, I'm heading off to war. God Almighty is my armor and sword, Palestine, forever Palestine. children being killed for throwing stones in the sky. They say to their parents, don't worry, God is on our side. Palestine forever, Palestine.
Welcome back, dear friends. So we were talking about how following a oppressive leader will destroy our ubudiyah, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to the Almighty Allah. So this now brings us to the present day. We talked a little bit about the past. We said that what would we consider ourselves to be? Would we consider ourselves to have religion? Would we consider ourselves to be religious? Would we consider ourselves to be engaged in a higher level of ubudiyah, worship and servitude and obedience to the Almighty Allah, if we were following somebody like Yazid, who, of course, historically we know killed the grandson of the Holy Prophet? He also ransacked the holy city of Medina, and he threw catapults and lay siege upon the holy city of Mecca. Of course, nobody would ever agree to be considered to be a religious person if they were to follow such a oppressive leader. So why limit our discussion to the past when Islam is a eternal religion? It is a final, complete, perfect, and eternal religion. And on the other hand, we, with this in mind, the teachings of Islam must be applicable to the present day. And also, we are responsible, just like the people in their own eras are responsible for their actions at that time. Neither will they be blamed for our actions, nor are we blamed for their actions. So in the present day, when we find that the fellow human beings, fellow Palestinian brothers and sisters, fellow Muslim brothers and sisters, and really fellow human beings, that's the most common denominator that we have. And it's a very strong denominator, right? But on top of that, there are also our Muslim brothers and sisters. We have a duty and a responsibility to help them. And one of the ways to help them, of course, is to not subject ourselves to follow oppressive leaders that are doing these things, right? If we subject ourselves to follow an oppressive leader, then, as the tradition that we stated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, we have no religion, we have no ubudiyah. And so by following a oppressive leader, we are destroying our ubudiyah. We are ruining, pretty much the purpose, fundamental purpose too, of our existence, which is ubudiyah, the worship, the servitude, and the obedience to the Almighty Allah. So we have to be very careful. Ubudiyah is not just a very abstract, conceptual, metaphysical reality that disconnects us from this material and physical world. No, we have to be in this physical world. And not only do we have to be in this physical world, but as the Imams have taught us that, opposition to oppression, is one of the principles of Islam and is one of the most beautiful things about Islam, that it stands up to the bullies of the world, to the oppressors of the world, and it stands up for the downtrodden and the oppressed of the world. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Foresight. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
لا إله سواه لا تخالطه الظنون ولا العيون تراه الله جل في علاه هو أنسي وملاذي أحتمي بحماه حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير حسبنا الله حسبنا الله حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل حسبنا الله حسبنا الله حسبنا الله ونعم
الوكيل. Iranian News. Iranian Culture. Iranian Voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
We are in the small central city of Mahallat, a small town that is mostly famous for its flowers. But here, I've come across something that I'm sure you're going to find interesting too.
The city is famous for an ancient water spring called Sarcheshme, flowing from the mountains in the north to the plain areas of the south. Many villages were built around the water spring since the Achaemenid era, eventually developing into the city that you see today. And this is where Mahallat, meaning several neighborhoods, gets its name from. It's no wonder that a city this old should have its own very unique souvenirs, maybe some kind of sweet with a very interesting story about how and why it was invented. And this is what I'm telling you about today. Now sesame seeds and the oily paste produced from grinding them, called tahini, are known to all. But the kind of sweet they're turned into in Mahallat is definitely unique.
The sesame that is used here is produced in Iran. They say that this sesame will give us a better quality tahini. Now, in order to get a creamy tahini with that nutty flavor, we have to roast seeds in the oven for at least 20 minutes.
Sesame seeds may be tiny, but they have huge health benefits, and this is probably the best way to include them in your daily diet, especially if you have a sweet tooth. Tahini gets its soft, creamy texture from the huge amount of fats in sesame seeds. Do not be alarmed, though. They are unsaturated, meaning that they are beneficial to the heart and your overall health. If you're not familiar with the term halva yet, you need to know that it refers to a kind of dense, sweet confection. There are many different types, but the one we're talking about is nut butter-based made with tahini. Although other cities in Iran have their own versions, and you can always get some from the local supermarket, they come by no means close to the ones produced in Mahallot. Now, if you're worried about acquiring dodgy hips and brittle bones later in life, and you're thinking of exploring alternative sources of calcium, this tahini halva is a great place to start. It is crumbly and melts in your mouth, and you can keep it at room temperature, which means it can be your on-the-go snack. And don't forget, it used to be the food of Iran's brave and strong warriors. Iranians will not wait to have halva, though. In the absence of it, a mixture of tahini and grape syrup called ardeshire is considered a perfect snack.
Now, when it comes to a traditional Iranian breakfast, tahini and the halva made with it have a very special place. Kisumish Ahmadi for Iran.
The Imam Reza Boulevard connects hundreds of cities together in the north of Iran. And one of the interesting features of this part of the country is that cities are built so tightly close to one another that it would be very difficult to distinguish the limits between them. For instance, right now I have one foot in the city of Nur and another foot in the city of Royan. And actually, it does feel kind of weird being in two cities at the same time.
Royan, formerly known as Alamdeh, is one of the favorite hangouts for those traveling in Mazandaran along the coastal route which connects the northern cities of Iran like a belt. Royan is the center of Nur County. With a population of just a little more than 6,000, the city hosts hundreds of thousands of tourists, especially in Iran's holiday season like the Nowruz and also in summertime. This tiny city in the north of Iran faces the Caspian Sea from the north and the beautiful Hyrkanian forests of the Alborz mountain range in the south. As I said, one of the things that the Royan region is famous for is its mountains, which are covered with the dense Caspian forests. By traveling along the road which passes through the Royan forests, you can see one of the world's unique natural environments, which is exclusive to a region known as Hyrkania, a green belt which is stretched along the southern coast of the Caspian Sea and a small part of the Republic of Azerbaijan.
Alpari is the name of one of the famous natural attractions in northern Iran. It's located in the heart of the Royan forest. And unlike other waterfalls that pour down in a 90-degree angle, the Alpari is more of a combination of swirling streams that pour down in between the rocks in a 45-degree angle.
The dazzling beauty of the region owes itself to the situation of the Alborz mountain range, which acts like a gigantic wall that prevents rain clouds of the Caspian Sea from escaping to the other side, thus creating abundant rainfall, which eventually results in the creation of this green explosion.
Lavit is a mountainous area near the city of Nur, a place famous for its honey production. But as you can see, it's winter time and the bees are sleeping. And besides, I'm not here to talk about honey because it's widely produced across Iran. Instead, I'm here to take you to a place which I'm sure you haven't visited before.
In addition to honey, Lavij is famous for its natural hot water springs. The water that boils from the ground contains a mixture of sulfur and minerals, which are believed to have miraculous healing effects on skin problems as well as skeletal pain. Mazandaran is a gifted land, full of attractions. This beautiful province presents a variety of choices for tourists and travelers who want to experience a different environment. The land of the sea, the forests, and breathtaking landscapes. Amir Mehdi Kazemi for Iran.
The earth and the heavens begin to sing. The angels celebrate the birth of a king. A king who outshines the stars of the night. A beacon of hope. You guide us with your blessings of God upon you is my prayer. The earth and the heavens begin to sing. This day we celebrate the birth of a king.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and thank you for staying with us on Iran Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. Muslim scholar Ibn al-Haytham, known as al-Hazan in Europe, who was born in 965 AD, formulated the scientific method and has been referred to as the world's first true scientist. He is also often regarded as the first theoretical physicist, making a significant contribution to the theory of light and optics. Additionally, he developed what is called celestial mechanics, which led to the eventual work of Europeans such as Copernicus, Galileo, Johannes Kepler, and Isaac Newton. We'll listen to the continuation of Iran Radio. Thank you for joining us. Coming up in this hour, we begin with the spotlight. Right after that, we turn to For Humanity, a reflective program that explores key aspects of human life as addressed in the Holy Quran, from personal development to social relationships and family dynamics. This segment offers a Quranic perspective on how to live with purpose and compassion in both private and communal life. Then stay tuned for Africa Today, where we take a comprehensive look at the political, economic, cultural, and business landscape across the African continent. This program provides a valuable overview of developments shaping Africa's present and future. Up next, Spotlight. Stay with us. There is much to explore.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to our Spotlight, everyone. Now, tonight's Spotlight will be a discussion of Iran's foreign policy principles. Tehran has time and again stated that its red lines and a handful of countries, mostly in the West, have time and again taken issue with this. Countries with strong missile arsenals want to deny Iran the same. Nuclear-armed nations want Tehran to completely disassemble its civilian nuclear program. And states with vulgar colonial past do not want Iran to stand for the oppressed, those living under apartheid, and victims of genocide. Now, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says the so-called talks with the United States are nothing but dictation under pressure. America's goal, he says, has never been a respectful diplomacy and engagement, but rather to, quote, strip Iran of its independence. And Ayatollah Khamenei added, only a strong nation can deter aggression and protect its dignity, warning that reliance on the U.S. or Western powers is a dangerous illusion. Let's first start with this quick report.
With the snapback mechanism set to take effect in a matter of days, tensions between Iran and Western powers led by the United States are reaching a boiling point. As Western powers seem increasingly reluctant to pursue diplomatic solutions and continue to exert pressure on Iran in an attempt to limit its legitimate rights, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has dismissed negotiations with Washington as futile, describing them as an effort to impose U.S. demands. He also warned that Washington's pressure campaign extends beyond the nuclear program, targeting Iran's missile program in an effort to erode the country's defensive capabilities. Meanwhile, Iran's President Masoud Pezeshkian addressed the 80th session of the United Nations General Assembly, condemning three European countries for initiating a process to reimpose UN sanctions under U.S. direction.
The three European countries, after failing to bring down the proud people of Iran through a decade of betrayal and support for military aggression, attempted to reinstate the revoked Security Council resolutions against Iran under the directive of the United States through pressure, bullying, imposition, and clear exploitation. In doing so, they set aside good faith, circumvented legal requirements, portrayed Iran's lawful compensatory measures in response to the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA and Europe's absolute betrayal and inability as gross violations.
Despite mounting pressure, Tehran continues to emphasize its commitment to diplomacy and cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency, even in the aftermath of a war imposed by Israel and the United States. Now the ball is in the West's court. Will Europe and the U.S. choose dialogue to defuse the crisis, or will maximum pressure policies deepen the divide?
And now for your guests. Joining us, Mr. Masoud Shajadeh, Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, joining us from London. And also joining us from London, Batul Subeiti, activist and political analyst. Hello, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess, Batul, we will start with you. Iran's leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, said the Washington's demand for Iran to dismantle its nuclear program completely proves U.S. is not seeking negotiations, but full surrender. Your initial take on that claim and the timing of it, as the Iranian delegation is in New York for this 80th U.N. General Assembly session.
Yes, good evening to you and your guest. The Iranian leadership has a very clear vision, and that is that negotiations with the United States are absolutely futile and should be treated, and as they are used, as a tool of deception that went to the extent of striking Iran in the midst of it. These negotiations cannot be trusted, particularly because they are not negotiations, but exactly as you mentioned in the question, a means of subjugation with their results predetermined. The goal is to impose these results, which involve the complete termination of Iran's nuclear project and going above and beyond that, because we know that the crux of the American issue with Iran is not the nuclear file. It is Iran as a model that represents complete freedom from the subjugation under American hegemony. And of course, America do not recognize, and the West for that matter collectively, they do not recognize the rights of the negotiating party here, which is Iran. They expect Iran to completely comply under its section whilst absolving itself and further going on to strike Iran in the midst of it, actually keeping on its side of its agreement. And they do not adhere to the results of the agreements, and they abandon them at any moment as tried and tested. And as we know, worst of all, negotiations have been used as a deception tool, preparing for a literal military assault on Iran. So this lack of trust makes these negotiations completely unwise, even naive or submissive for those who are engaging in them. And the crux of Sayyid Ali Khamenei's speech was to say how the strategy of the Iranian nation should be to strengthen itself internally. Whoever harms Iran is harmed back. Whoever conspires, threatens, will receive the like. Whoever hits, we will hit back. We need to look inwards and build the technological components that give us strength and deterrence, because the other side wants to leave us completely defenseless, as it's proven in the whole region. So America's threats, its force, its lack of compliance with every international law, its lack of compliance with basic morals, does not mean that Iran listens or cows down. Iran will never bow down to America. There should be someone in the world that says no to the arrogant and oppressive powers, and the leader says this without any hesitation. He doesn't walk with America to prevent America's anger or force, but rather this is the only language that the other side understands, and that is that if you conspire against us, we will conspire against you.
Well, very well said, Batul. Thank you. Mr. Shahjadeh, welcome to the program. Thank you for your patience. As the Iranian president reiterated once again that the UN General Assembly, Iran, through bona fide religious fatwa, is not after an atomic bomb. It's like beating a dead horse. I don't know how many times we have to go to the second broken record player and mention this, but obviously we can't have a program, a sit down like this, speak of Iran's foreign policy principles without talking about Iran's civilian nuclear program. Iranian leader just yesterday said that they know this, and he implied that they've known this, they've always known this, but they don't care. They want a pretext to impose their will, as Batul was saying, to thwart Iran's advancement scientifically, militarily, defensively, economically, until Iran is no longer independent.
Absolutely. And I think we need to realize what is happening around the world. Diplomacy is dead. International law is dead. Look, we have gone through right now almost two years of a genocide, which has been so visual, been beamed into our telephones, streamed into our telephones, TV stations, etc., etc. And international law and diplomacy has not been able to save one single life. This is not just about Iran. This is about the fact that we are sleepwalking into a future of genocide, future of no international law, in basic future, which is jungle, law of the jungle. And what is there often, United States and the Western so-called nation, are it's nothing to do with justice, nothing to do with fairness, it's nothing to do with understanding that Iran has, as you said, over and over and over, saying that they are not going to go for a nuclear weapon. As a matter of fact, if they wanted to, Iran could have had a nuclear bomb by now. And everyone knows that. You know, even all the intelligence agencies, their reports in the United States identify that, and there are a testimony to this fact. So what is going on